Today we are joined by Dr. Aned Patel as we discuss the GP's Guide to Male Fertility. In this episode, we talk about what to expect when you first visit the GP, how to navigate those first difficult conversations, and the shocking gap in medical training around male fertility. If you've ever felt dismissed or wondered why you haven't been referred sooner, this episode is for you. Welcome to the Male Fertility Podcast. Today we are joined by GP, broadcaster, and leading expert in male health and sexual medicine, Aned Patel. Welcome.
Hello. Thank you very much, Sean and Kieran. Lovely to be here.
Pleasure to have you. And as I said just before, there's only one name at the top of the bill that we wanted on to talk about GPs, fertility and men, and that was you. So thanks so much for coming on.
That's very kind. I don't think there's a particularly long list of GPs in fertility, so I'm delighted to be near the top.
Can you just give us a little bit of background about how you became to specialise in male sexual health?
Sure. I was a hospital doctor. Most people start after their training, but after doing my medical exams, I dropped out and became a school teacher for 3 years and was head of sex ed, which was hilarious and disastrous at the same time for a bunch of 13 to 18 year olds. And obviously that kind of opened my eyes to like conversations young people are having around sex, which is very much not necessarily anything you learn about, certainly not in my school days, and certainly not when you're training to be a GP. And then I went back into medicine, trained to be a GP, and had no training in fertility, no training in sexual function, no training in infertility or problems like that. It was very much the day-to-day things, knees problems, elbow problems, chest infections, heart attacks. It wasn't the fertility issues at all. Then became a trainer. I organized training for GPs. And one of the first people I met on our training course who was doing a fantastic session on psychosexual medicine was Victoria Lehman, who is the most amazing psychosexual therapist and really one of the old OGs of psychosexual medicine. I thought this is really interesting and like nothing that we've ever covered before. So I did a training course at the European Society of Sexual Medicine, did a couple of weeks there, and it was just mind blowing, like stuff I'd never learned before. Discussing if someone in a Uruguayan prison is having sex with another man, does that make them gay? And all these kind of weird conversations that you have when you've had a couple of pints and you're with people from around the world discussing sex and sex acts. And it was incredible. But then so it came out of that with my qualification in sexual medicine. And then on the other side of that, then just got into testosterone because actually, again, isn't covered in the GP curriculum. We don't really learn about it. And obviously testicles do two things. They're factories, aren't they? They make sperm and they make testosterone. I learned nothing about that. I was already 30-something before I did my sexual medicine training. And it was only then that I started to know about it. And I only learned about the testosterone bit, didn't learn about the fertility bit. Then I did 10 years plus in testosterone and male sexual problems like erection problems and premature ejaculation. And then finally, I ended up doing a TV show with Jonathan Ramsay. And I came on just because I'd just done Embarrassing Bodies and the Channel 4 producer at the time thought, why don't we see if we can get you in to do this? And I had no bloody idea about male infertility at all. I translated a few semen analyses, having to Google it, look it up on the clinical knowledge summaries. It's not quite as bad as Googling. There are actual helpful guides for GPs that summarize the important information before you start looking horrified at me. However, basically that doesn't have a huge amount of information on male infertility and how to treat it. It's mostly understanding with the women, but actually what you get in male care is very limited. You know, Jonathan was chatting with me and I was going, I don't know half the words that you're using. I don't know half the acronyms. It felt like just like being back at university and all the ologies and you're like, oh my God, what is this? And he, do you want to come and train with me? And he offered me a job. And I was like, why don't I just sit in with you for a bit and learn? Jonathan sees people that have been trying. They've had 15 rounds of IVF. They've spent hundreds of thousands of pounds and yet they haven't tested the man in some cases. And you go, what? That seems like blindingly obvious. They're 50% of the infertility cases and it's 1 in 6 couples. Why aren't we checking on the men? And I recognize that as a GP, I didn't know about it. I got trained in it by Jonathan. Are there any good guidelines about it? No, they're not. They're either very urology focused, which is like male specific health, testicular, penile function, or they're very basic because the clinical knowledge summaries or guidance for GPs pretty much says do a semen analysis, which is a good test. But if it's wrong, do another semen, or not very good, do another semen analysis after 3 months. And if that's a problem, potentially do a chlamydia test and then refer them. But there's no sort of mention of doing hormone checking. There's no mention of investigating further. And so actually the information we're given as GPs is minimal because if it's not in our curriculum, we're not going to know about it. If no one's really teaching us about it at medical school, because I think I had 1 hour on the testicles at medical school, I've managed to go 15 years into my medical career and not really know anything about it. So I've spent the last 10 to 15 years learning otherwise and educating myself.
Yeah, it's an interesting story, like from where you started to where you are now. And there's things I'd like to echo in terms of the discussions that, shall we say, senior school children have. Some of it's completely bizarre. And you think, are you on the same planet as we are?
The teaching's all about avoiding STIs and avoiding pregnancy. There's nothing about actually, what do I do in a relationship? There is now. And obviously, certainly we started to do that in our sex ed and stuff. There's lots of consent training, which is great now. But what isn't there is like, actually, if you do want to get pregnant, what's going to happen to your hormones? What's going to happen to your sperm quality? What's going to happen if you do X, Y job? You know, if you leave it later, does that matter? Because it's just all about making sure you've got a condom on or abstinence. And you're like, that's not what we need to look at. We're not there to terrify young people into avoiding sexual relationships and then feeling the massive shame if they do get into relationships or if they do have an STI. And they think, oh my God, this is the worst thing in the world. You're like, actually, it isn't, because so many people have them.
Yeah.
But equally, perhaps we could have helped you come to terms with that or understand that a bit more. And actually, the fertility thing is getting so big now, isn't it? The fact we've got sperm counts dropping by 50% in 50 years is horrifying. And luckily, I was able to attend a meeting at the Houses of Parliament with Jonathan and with the Fertility Network and Katie Rollins. And it was just fantastic. It was a great opportunity. But also talking to these MPs who were there and their advisors, just going, look, we are in a significant problem. We've got the lowest birth rate in Europe in the UK. We are, I've got birth rate approaching Korea, which we know is approaching some sort of sociological meltdown because of their demographic structure. They are going to have too few people to look after their elderly people. Who's going to look after us as an aging society? So there's this incredible thing about actually, what do we need to talk about at a much bigger level, at a government level, about how we populate this country to be able to manage the economics that we need? Who's paying our tax and who's paying our pension when we get older? All of this stuff actually depends on our birth rate, and that's falling.
Yeah, so true. I've read about Korea and it's quite concerning.
Yeah. Yeah, obviously the one-child policy in China has had a massive impact in terms of there's far more boys than girls now as a proportion, and that's causing big problems sociologically. But equally, there's big issues in terms of, because of the one-child policy, their population is going to shrink and people are having children later or deciding to have one child or no children. They're actually making a personal choice that maybe that's not for them. And actually, the shrinking of that country is going to be huge in terms of impact on workflows around the world.
It comes down to education, doesn't it? It's approaching very quickly, that population issue.
If our sperm count rate falls as it's been going, the rate of fall has increased since 2000 in terms of our number of sperm. And if we carry on at this rate, we're going to be potentially infertile or subfertile by 2045, which is 20 years away. We can't afford to ignore it now. There's so much stuff to be looking at in terms of pollutants, environmental chemicals, the plastics we have our food in. But it's just about making sure that governments are engaged in terms of what are the chemicals in our pesticides that are damaging fertility? What are the chemicals in our perfume sprays, cosmetics, fake tan? The entire cast of Towie or Made in Chelsea are potentially infertile from the amount of fake tan they use alone. I think it's really important that we look at this as a country, and the education starts from the top and from grassroots with our kids.
Yeah, you mentioned Katie, like the work she's doing is outstanding. We must get her on actually to talk about that. How was that conversation received when you were in Parliament?
Clearly the country has a lot going on at the moment and there's not very much money. And so actually I recognise this is yet another thing, but actually given the fact that male infertility is such a massive problem and fertility in general is a massive problem, it needs to be much higher up their agenda. But it was great being invited, and it takes so much work to get your foot in there. So actually to have the people of quality that they have there, it was just amazing.
The interesting thing is that without fertility, nothing else really matters. If you look at it big time, the taxes doesn't matter because there will be no one to produce it. It's a long-term thing, isn't it? But at least with the conversations going in the right direction, and sex education at school is no longer sat there with a banana trying to put a condom on it. There is more conversation, because I know me and Sean have had a discussion in the past about that was our sex education.
I didn't work.
I said it before, mate. I swear it was a cucumber. Yeah, but maybe that's just me doing the typical bloke thing of overcompensating. But I swear it was a cucumber, not a banana.
We had a series of ethnically diverse penile demonstrators, but that's because I'd bought a job lot from Durex, I think it was. And then I lost the box and I had to send an email to all my colleagues going, I seem to have lost a box of 50 penises. If someone finds it, could they let me know? And basically, I'd had a couple of beers in the common room, put the box on a shelf and completely forgotten about it. Luckily, I found it before PSHE.
It's an interesting thing for the cleaner to find.
It's really good to hear that the conversation is starting from a younger age and around fertility issues, and hopefully drive that change really from the kids upwards, because our generation, really, we sleptwalked into this. And like you mentioned, with just the general environmental issues that we live with every day, what we do, what we put on our body. Like you said, you know, like that. I heard something that said, unless you're willing to eat something, you shouldn't put it on your body, because essentially you're going to absorb it anyway.
Really good adage, actually. Would I chew on a lipstick? Probably not. But actually, you put it on your lips and you end up swallowing half of it. It is absolutely all the stuff that young men are being told on like fragrance talk that they need to spray themselves with. These fragrances are hanging around up to 24 hours on their skin, and you're thinking, how much of that are you absorbing? And it's meant to be like 70% synthetics, 30% naturals. That's why the European regulations were really important, because they were used to remove certain chemicals that were present in fragrances, the IFRA regulations. But one of the major components of it actually was a fertility disrupting chemical that they removed a few years ago. And people are like crying on TikTok going, why don't our fragrances smell like they used to? And to be fair, they did make them last longer. The problem was obviously they made you infertile. So It's really important that actually we have these sort of what feels like big brother impositions, but actually they're keeping us and our bodies safe. We just don't want all that hormone disrupting chemicals over our body. And also the stuff about people watching so much social media and they're getting into influencers who are telling them they should be having this type of steroid, for example, if they're bodybuilding. Everyone wants to have a body that comes off Love Island. And you know what Love Island's doing to our 16 to 18 year olds wanting that muscly body as soon as possible and getting their gear from Gary at the gym or whoever's supplying it to them, or off the internet or wherever, because it's just so available now. And what that's doing to their testicular function, it's incredible. Even some doctors were prescribing testosterone to men to try and improve their fertility. And we know now that if you give someone straight testosterone, it switches off a lot of your fertility. So it's really important that if you are testosterone deficient, which we know is an important factor in terms of maintaining fertility, you need to be treated in the right way to stimulate your body system and your body hormonal conversation with your brain communicating with your testicles, rather than switching that communication off, because you're just going to end up with tiny soft testicles that don't produce any testosterone or sperm.
I do feel these people get taken in by that need to take like steroids, for example, thinking that's what I need to do to get the girls, and then they get the girl and then they can't reproduce because of what they've done to get there. Yeah. And it's one thing for us to say as middle ages and around that bracket. Kieran's not quite there yet, so
easy on the middle age.
But so we've been through that, and you learn what's important and what it's important to be. But I was fortunate enough to not grow up in the internet era, so
I didn't have my phone until I was 24. I'm so delighted about it. I spent my entire medical school not having anything documented, which is just as it should be.
Let's talk about, if a guy's going to his GP, what can a GP realistically do for him during that first appointment?
First of all, you'll be having it's great that you've come to speak to us. That's the first step, because so many people don't want to talk about their fertility. They're embarrassed about it or ashamed about it. We're always told it's so easy to get pregnant and I can't get pregnant, and that's an issue. Well done for getting over that hurdle. And then just to have a frank chat, just, you know, I'm here because I'm concerned about my fertility. And either because perhaps it's something you've done in terms of taking hair loss medication, which we know now potentially can affect some men's fertility, or I'm worried because I took 3 months of anabolic steroids in my 20s. And now me and my girlfriend have difficulty getting pregnant. Or even the LGBT couples, which where it is slightly more complicated in terms of getting pregnant and the issue with surrogacy in the UK, et cetera, et cetera. So it can be the start of a conversation with that. If you're in a heterosexual relationship, often people haven't had a child by a year, and 80% of couples are pregnant by 1 year, and then about 90 to 95% by 2 years. So in most people, it'll happen if they're under the age of 35. But as you get over 35, and particularly for the woman, fertility starts to decline. Now, it's not off a cliff, but it does reduce year on year. I think I heard a stat that if you're in your early 20s, 1 in 4 eggs can get pregnant. By the time you are 40, 1 in 20 eggs can get pregnant. Hopefully they'll talk to you about what your past has been like. Have you had any hormonal treatment or problems in the past? Have you had any cancer, chemotherapy, which would obviously change your potential fertility levels? Have you had the operations on your genitals, et cetera, et cetera? Were you born with your testicles up in your tummy or in the canals and they had to be brought down? All that kind of thing. Hopefully they'd examine you, but actually that's not in the CKS guidance. So they may not examine you. They may offer you some blood tests, but they probably won't. The first line thing that you're offered according to the CKS guidance for infertility is actually doing a semen analysis, which actually is the biggest standard test in the UK anyway. They're really looking at whether that you've got swimmers. Can the sperm swim? So it's called motility. The concentration, which is the number of sperm per milliliter. And most men produce like 1.5 to 5 mils of sperm in each shot. And then finally, they're looking for morphology, which is the shape. Now, shape's a bit like operator dependent because it depends on looking down a microscope at it, whereas the other two are a bit more standardized. Those are three really important things that give you a gauge on fertility. If you've got problems with all three, morphology, motility, and concentration, you've got 15 to 16 times increased risk of subfertility or infertility. So it's really important to get yourself checked out. They do one sample and it's fine. Then off you go, try for another year if you've been trying for a year. But obviously your partner will be probably having tests at the same time. If, however, it's abnormal, they'll do a second test and they'll probably offer it to you somewhere between 2.5 to 3 months later, because that's how long it takes to make a new cycle of sperm. Unlike women who have all the eggs they're born with, men make new sperm every 74 days. So it just means that if you can make some changes in your lifestyle, hopefully, you know, your GP would offer you some advice about your lifestyle, cut out the smokes, reduce the caffeine that you're drinking, reduce your alcohol to less than 3 or 4 units per week. Because we know that anything over that is going to increase your risk of infertility significantly. Cycling reduces your sperm count by about 30% if you're doing it for more than 90 minutes a week. So please don't cycle. Moderate exercise seems to increase all of the sperm parameters. Weightlifting to a moderate level, again, increase your sperm parameters. Don't wear too much lycra, reduce the heat. So all of this information you can be given about eating healthy, et cetera, is hopefully what's given to the patient. They go off and do their second one and hopefully it's returned to normal. But if it hasn't returned to normal, that's when you're potentially offered a chlamydia test and then sent to a specialist. Some people send them to the general fertility clinic, which is more unfortunately female-led, which I understand in the past, but actually given men are more of an issue now, you should also be referred to a urologist, a specialist in male fertility.
Yeah, you mentioned something interesting there. If you go as a man, because you have questions about your own fertility, would your partner automatically be tested? Because we've spoken to loads and loads of men that their partners have been referred, but they haven't. But should it be happening hand in hand? And as someone going, can you ask for it? Can you put forward and say, I would like to be tested too, because I've got concerns in this area?
It's always helpful if both of you go. Because one, it just means that you're going to support each other, inform each other, etc. There's always going to be something you're going to forget to mention because you're anxious about wanting to say everything. So just do that. Go together, book a double appointment, one for each of you, and then just actually set out your stool. There'll likely be blood tests. There might be a scan for the woman, and there may be other investigations set up. There might be a referral set up if necessary, given your past history. But generally on the first thing, it's blood tests. And then that's it. And then for the man, it'll be a semen analysis. And then you come back with results to review what's happened. And then I'd be referred together or together and separately for the man.
Can a bloke advocate for themselves to get in front of an andrologist or urologist?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think one of the major things is actually Googling the guidance for GPs. Because actually, if you know what we know and what we're meant to do, generally, that's what we follow. And if you look on the website, so your general practice usually has a website, often that you'll have a women's specialist doctor, but you'd probably want your wife or your partner to see her or him. However, you may want to also check to see if there's a male health specialist there. And if there is, I'd probably try and go to them as well to try and get that reviewed. But equally, there's loads of doctors that don't know anything about these guidances because they're just not published. They're not publicized very much.
And that's something that we are keen to highlight here. This is not anything about GP bashing or anything, because like you said, you deal with the same things mostly day in, day out. And when someone comes in, you aren't expected to know it all, of course. But if that person can do it, just help you out a little bit and say, yeah, actually, I've checked this out.
Generally, we're adults, you're adults. And it's really nice just to have an adult conversation with someone. Yeah. It's like, let's just have a chat about it. And that's really helpful. Yeah, no, I think that is really important. But equally, if you don't get the response that you think you should be getting, it's okay to speak to one of the other doctors. That's fine.
Yeah.
And I do recognize that there is the concept of the pushy patient, and I do get that. And equally, there's the dismissive doc. They're ends of a spectrum, right? But you do want to advocate for yourself. If you've got information that suggests you should be treated in a different way, give them the information. I don't mind receiving a bit of paperwork that you've printed off that suggests how you patients should be treated in male fertility. That's absolutely fine. And the issue you might find is that just the NHS isn't programmed to deliver that, and it may have to come at the hospital level. But we know that actually some hospitals aren't actually doing things like DNA fragmentation, which we now know is so important in terms of fertility testing. So it's the NHS is there for population health, but I think what we need to do is really be looking at as fertility as one of the main pillars of it, because it's so important for our future.
Yeah. And you mentioned actually earlier about testosterone. So I always had, from when I got tested fertility-wise onwards, lower end of normal kind of levels, especially for a mid-30-year-old. I should have been a lot higher. Then following my micro-TZ, in conjunction with hypogonadism, my levels dropped off a cliff. I did everything I could over nearly a year to, I didn't want to go on TRT because I knew it was a lifelong commitment. But I became so educated about it and trying to reverse those effects and just know what to do, what not to do, that when eventually I had no choice but to go to the GP about that. And just like you said, I had that adult conversation. I said, look, these are all the symptoms. It's quite frankly miserable. I've done everything I can. And actually my levels went down, which was still annoys me to this day. But then what can you do? But yeah, and I said, look, I really need to get in front of an endocrinologist. And they were great.
Good that you had that experience, because unfortunately some people don't have a very positive experience, and that's a real shame. And also the boundaries, the lab reference ranges are often so low that it's almost impossible to get like a low testosterone level in some places. So definitely I would recommend having a look at the British Society of Sexual Medicine guidance, which uses action levels which are higher. So instead of having a lower level of say 8 or 6 or below, they look at a level of about 12 for most men and 14 for men who've got diabetes and cardiovascular disease. If you've got diabetes or cardiovascular disease and you've got testosterone deficiency, you are more likely to die. It's really important that we keep that testosterone level up. But as you say, you want to be given the right type of testosterone stimulator. So not testosterone itself. You want to potentially be given a medication like Clomid or Anastrozole, whichever one's appropriate for you, that will stimulate the brain to increase FSH and LH and then trigger more testicular function. But that only works if your testicle factories are working. Now, if you've had a micro-TZ, now generally that's a very gentle way of, as gentle as is possible, of opening up the testicle and retrieving sperm. It sounds barbaric, and it is, but you're like teasing apart the testicular tissue to try and find the odd, slightly fatter slug of tube, which might be making some sperm, and select that rather than what they used to do, which is like multiply harpoon the testicle, which would destroy not only the sperm-producing parts, but also the testosterone-producing part. It's very much like factory damage, and if you damage those factories, they're gone.
My highest known level in the mid-30s was about 12, and then it just dropped after that. And I think it was probably very likely that I was going to end up on TRT at a young-ish age anyway.
So many men now in their 20s and 30s with testosterone deficiency, it's absolutely ridiculous. And you're thinking, if the testicles are factories, it's not just like sperm reduction and testosterone is separate. You need high levels of intratesticular testosterone to make sperm production occur. It's particularly important for the second part of sperm production. So actually, if you've got low testosterone levels, it doesn't matter how good your sperm production is, just the numbers are going to drop, the quality is going to drop. And if that's happening because of external factors, which mostly it probably is, but these external factors could be happening in the womb. It could be the fact that mum was cooking healthy meals, but heating them up in a plastic containers. We have no idea about the quality of the plastics and the xenoestrogens and the hormonal effects that those chemicals are having in our body, the microplastics, which we know now are going to the placenta and in the womb. So, you know, what's happening to the developing fetal gonads, the ovaries and the testicles in the womb, let alone about when they come out? If you've got problems with your factories before you even start, what's the likelihood of you having a decent testosterone level or sperm production in later life? Not so good. So maybe that's what's been happening over the last 50, 60 years.
That's so interesting. I hadn't heard that before. And it's, when you actually think about it, it makes complete sense. And
we've been doing it for years. And I know more recently, people are aware of your BPAs and your phthalates and all these things that you're meant to try and avoid. But they've been in our system for years. And some of these last many years, and their impact can be very long, because they don't just affect the DNA that creates proteins and stuff. It also affects the sort of quiet DNA, that bit of DNA that actually is the instruction manual. So if the instruction manual is screwed up, imagine trying to put together an IKEA cupboard if the instruction manual is written incorrectly. It's never going to happen. So it's us being aware of all of that.
I can't even do that with the instructions. You mentioned if a bloke was to go to the GP, the first thing you'd say is thanks for coming, because there are so many that don't, and avoid it until probably being pushed or it's the last possible moment. So What do you think is the reason behind that? Obviously around fertility, but we know that men's health in general is suffering because we aren't going to the doctors early enough or often enough.
You get taught in school that you're going to get someone pregnant just by looking at them. And so actually there's this sense that I will get someone pregnant. That's just going to happen. And you are a result of pregnancy. So that's impressive in itself. So there you are thinking that you're able to do that and then you can't. And that's really shameful. Now, I think there is that thing about masculinity and what masculinity means. And obviously, if you've got virility being like the worshipped at that altar, part of that is how many kids have you had? There is that thing about, yeah, he's got six baby mamas hanging by his side. And you're thinking, is that a sign of virility or is that a sign that you just don't know how to use a condom? These themes need to be challenged. But we know Charlie Chaplin was having children in his 70s, but we know now that men in their 50s have got sperm that is half as good and half as many as it was when they were 30. So the decline is real, not just over time, as in over the years. It's real in terms of a person aging. We want to make sure that we're encouraging men to not be just a bit macho about it. And actually, if you are having an issue or you're thinking about your fertility, you're thinking about if you want to get pregnant with your partner in the future, have a conversation with us. Even if you've not been trying for very long, just have a conversation about what lifestyle things you can change. If you're on medication, let's have a look at it. If you're taking over-the-counter stuff, let's think about whether that's appropriate for you. Because there's so much that people take. If you're starting to recede and you're starting to take your finasteride or minoxidil, etc., have a conversation. Now, like some doctors aren't going to know necessarily what it does, but you just have to type finasteride into ChatGPT, for example, and it will tell you the effect and the impact it can have on your testosterone production and on your fertility. Yes, it keeps your hair, but at what risk? It's about a balanced conversation. And so actually, do you want to go for topical treatment, which will still be absorbed, but not to the same degree, rather than oral treatment? It's about making an informed choice.
I remember that on that program where Russell came that was using minoxidil and it was just like immediately like that has to stop.
He was using four times the listed amount. I can say that because he was saying it on the program. He was just using a really high dose of it, which keeps obviously he's got brilliant head of hair. Don't get me wrong. I think he had something like 12 million sperm, which is in the infertile range. It's important. And he's increased to 20 million sperm just in that short period, but he didn't entirely stop the minoxidil. So you know, it's about, you know, what he already had a child. So, you know, that's one of the differences. If you don't have it, you probably want to maximize all your chances. Fertility for men is just so many different things which are additive. Don't wear too many hot genital-hugging clothing. Make sure that you are eating the right foods. Don't overdo the supplements because actually they can push you the other way from oxidative stress into redux stress. So it's about making sensible choices with everything that you do. And I appreciate that's a pain because you're having to look at your lifestyle for 6 months, 8 months, a year. But actually, if you're trying for a kid, in a few years' time, you're not going to really remember that year that you had to give up smoking for a bit. Hopefully, you'll have your kid.
Yeah, that really stood out to me on that program, actually, where you had a bloke who has a child, so proven fertility, as they say, but then got told that he had a low sperm count. And to see that, the impact it had on him. So, yeah, it just shows how deep this runs and how hard-hitting it can be.
Because Russell's a real biohacker. He really tries to look deeply into his health, and you'll see him a lot on social media talking about that. And he does look after himself, and he looks incredible for his age. He's doing all of the right things, but it's just that some of them are appearance-focused, perhaps, rather than health-focused, if that makes sense. And I think there's a difference.
Yeah, it comes back to what we were discussing earlier in terms of those environmental issues or chemicals that are out there that we don't actually know what they're doing to us.
And no.
If you see it on an advert or it's advertised in a certain way, you automatically trust it. And in fact, it's not always the best thing for you, is it? In terms of what's in it and the effect it has on your health.
One thing I wanted to mention, just talking about, is just something Jonathan Ramsay talks about, because he sees a lot of men with infertility. And actually he says breaking the news to someone that they've got infertility is as bad as telling them they've got cancer.
Yeah.
And I think we forget that actually that is such an imposition on their psychological state that is so upsetting for many men to hear. It's equally upsetting for women to hear that as well. I'm not taking that away from women at all, but actually, if we're speaking about men's fertility here, it's a massive punch to the gut. And I think being told you're infertile, or potentially infertile from a semen analysis that we've done once, is really not what we should be doing. We need to be, as GPs, being trained better, being given better guidance, better guidelines, better teaching formats. And that's what we're trying to do by the Royal College of General Practitioners. We now, in our sort of yearly men's health training, which I'm chair for, we now have a session for male fertility, what GPs can be doing and what extra tests should you know about to try and help people along their journey. What lifestyle changes can people make to try and boost their fertility? We're trying to be as helpful as possible. You know, the last time we did it, we had 2,000 doctors on our call. We are getting the word out, and loads of these are late stage trainees. So they're right at the level where they've got all the information, and then they're going to start being baby GPs. But they're fully trained now, have all of that information. We want every generation to be better than the last and more educated and more able to communicate and recognize the impact of fertility. Jonathan's really clear about actually look after the men that they may not actually tell you what they're going through. They may not want to confess. They may not want to show feeling. They may also be deferring to their partner because actually they're like, actually, I can't show my distress because my partner's distressed. And that can be another thing. We're not allowed to be vulnerable. Yeah, we're meant to man up. And you're like, actually, it's tough. And there's not that many male-focused fertility therapy groups or therapists specializing in male fertility issues. So it's really important that actually people spread that when they've got fertility therapy. It's for the whole couple or whatever gender they are.
Yeah, definitely. My personal experience of that first diagnosis, I lost part of myself. Like I generally did. You just feel horrendous because it's that stigma, that manly, like stereotypical figure that you think you should be is taken away in one conversation. And then obviously you go to the doctors or you've been to the doctors. This happened to me when I actually went to the clinic. You've got to do this. You've got to do that. Completely overwhelmed with everything that I'm supposed to change with no guidance. And you slip into this emotional state that no one should get to. But it comes down to providing resources for these guys. And it can start with the GPs, can't it? That first delivery, first contact to say, look, we haven't got all the answers right now, but you're safe. We've got you.
And also it's about the resources to be able to refer people to. They're just not that many andrology fertility specialists. And that's around the world.
Yeah.
The reason that, for example, when I went to the Indian fertility conference, there was so much male fertility. I was like, my God, there's like 20 hours of it. Whereas we went to the British one and there was what, 3 hours of it, 4 hours of it. And that's because the gynecologists have to do a lot of the andrology because there just aren't enough male fertility specialists out there. So they'll be doing the testicular extractions. Mm-hmm. With a needle in about 10 mils of salt water. It's quite extraordinary.
Wow. Makes me wince.
It was quite terrifying and like quite leg crossing when I was like, they were just, oh, we just shove it in, do this. And I was going, oh God, wow. Oh,
it's making me sweat nearly as much as saying harpooning your balls earlier.
I literally was talking to an andrologist last week in person. She mentioned a few surgical sperm retrieval stories and I was wincing. And having been through it, it's just, yeah, it never gets...
It's barbaric. Yeah. For the women, it's barbaric. For the men, it's barbaric. For everyone, it's barbaric. So actually trying to make that as functional as possible, as quick as possible, because that's the other thing. Everything seems to take ages in the NHS, and I totally get that. It's weird that we've now got lots of doctors out of work because they can't get jobs because actually we can't afford to pay them. It is absolutely extraordinary, and we've got a lack of specialists in general practice, but also specialists in the hospital that can actually then see these people and review them and assess them. And I think we need to make infertility sexy. We need to make that a really fascinating career choice that's because it is intellectually interesting. Also works with people on a really emotional level. And you can do so much to change things. So it's one of those lovely things where there is potential. These outcomes can be significantly improved by often small tweaks. I mean, one of my other jobs at Manual, we're just trying to make sure that the treatment we give our testosterone patients also looks at and supports their fertility.
Yeah, 100%.
We have specific questions that kind of mean that we're trying not to diminish people's fertility. And if they want to have kids the next 6 months, we're potentially going to say no to you. And I know there are other companies that are going, yeah, fine, have it. And you're like, we're not doing that. Actually, do you need the HCG to keep your testicle function going? But even then, we know that in the few people, that doesn't help either because actually the testosterone itself overwhelms it. So I would really recommend if you do think you've got a testosterone problem, please go and see a specialist that knows what they're talking about and keeps in mind those issues like your fertility, if that's important to you. And obviously, it may not be important when you're 25, but it may become important in 10 years' time. So someone who's got that kind of thought with you in mind rather than just like a money-making scheme.
Yeah, it's good to know. Actually, I listened to a podcast with someone from Manual recently. They're on Joe Marler's talking about hair replacement stuff. It was brilliant. It was so informative, and he wasn't there as a sales pitch. He was literally saying there are ways in which you can do things before having to come to us. And I thought that was so refreshing.
I mean, I'm biased, obviously, because I work with them, but actually I genuinely think they're a really good company. And it's just about trying to make sure that if you are giving healthcare to men, that why not make it good?
We talked briefly there about what people can do in terms of preparation.
I probably listened to a couple of podcasts. You've been great. You've been talking about it for a very long time. So actually find out an introductory podcast on what fertility is. Know what it is. Know what the biology. Know your anatomy. That's always helpful. I know it sounds like I've been a school teacher, so maybe I sound like a school teacher when I'm saying this. But actually, if you know what your body's for, you're not scared about it. And if you think about your body as a machine, then it takes away the personal nature of it. I haven't failed. It's just actually that tiny bit of my brain isn't producing the correct amount of hormone, which means I then don't produce sperm properly. That's fine. It's a machine, right? Men tend to understand machines. I know lots of women do as well, but men tend to work in quite a robotic, obvious way. And I think if you understand that, you will then think, I am not the problem personally, but there is part of my engineering that isn't up to scratch. And actually, I need to support that. It's not working as well as it might, or I'm affecting it by the stuff I'm doing. So if you already understand that, it might be even at the start of your journey, you've not wanted to get pregnant yet, but you might want to in 2 or 3 months' time. Do the work now. Work out the times of her cycle that she'll be most fertile. Work out what's happening to you. Work out actually going, maybe I do need to stop my hair loss medication now. Because actually I'll hopefully get improvement in my sperm count by the time we do start. Because for men, it's 3 months to improve. For women equally, the first, you know, that 4 months before they release that egg is really key at getting that egg in the best condition. So it's really that preconception counseling that you want to know about. And so hopefully if you can pick that information up before you're actually trying, that's really helpful. Join a group if you can online, you know, learn some information. Obviously, Reddit probably isn't the best because you get so much mad information. There are certain podcasts which feel a little bit full on, shall we say. So I try and find the sensible stuff that's middle of the road, really, but which isn't too wild. But yeah, if you follow you guys and test them, you're not going to go far wrong, are you?
Our new platform, Nexus, is all about that. It's cutting out internet hype and misinformation and expert-led stuff. So yeah, like webinars with andrologists and whoever, just because we've been there, we know what it's like when you use Dr. Google or Reddit or groups on certain other social media platforms where you've got patients diagnosing other patients, which is not the route we want to go down.
Absolutely. And also there'll be some people taking testosterone who've never had a problem with their fertility. And that can then be like, oh, but I'll be fine too then. People tend to be quite optimistic about themselves. They won't be that 5 out of 100 or 30 out of 100. They'll be the 70 that were fine. Well, how do we inform ourselves? If you've listened to a few podcasts, you've looked online, you've looked at what the NHS offers, to Google that. You know, if you type in CKS and then the condition, so CKS knee, CKS fertility, CKS osteoporosis, whatever it is, it will give you what the NHS generally suggests is the right treatment for these people and when you should assess someone. So if you know you've only been trying for 2 months and you're under 30, give it a while. But actually, if it's been a year, or if you've got some of the sort of like higher risk categories, so you're over a certain age, if you're a woman, or if, for example, you've had a testicle that didn't come down properly, if you're a man, if you know that you've got a varicocele, anything like that, then that might up your readiness to go and see a doctor sooner than a year or 6 months.
Yeah, definitely. And you mentioned like what is available. Once a bloke is in the system, so to speak, and they've perhaps had a adverse result with a semen analysis, what's the next step and how do they go about navigating that pathway?
So hopefully they get an appointment with the andrologist, so the fertility specialist urologist who does basically male genitalia and their problems. You go and see your urologist or andrologist and they will assess you. They'll probably examine you, so be prepared for that. Wear some baggy clothes that are easy to take off. So they'll examine your testicles. They'll talk about your sexual function. They'll want to know if you've got premature ejaculation, because some people actually ejaculate so quickly they never get to penetrate. It's quite an in-depth conversation because it's not just purely about, are your sperm good enough to get there? It's like, how do they get there? And part of that is, can you get an erection? If you get an erection, do you ejaculate? Because some people don't. They ejaculate backwards into their bladder. So you'll be asked quite personal questions. So do be aware of that, okay? They'll be asking, how often do you have sex? And often people look affronted and you're like, it's part of getting pregnant. When are you having sex? What type of sex are you having? Where are you putting your penis? Because we know that if you've got that, having more anal sex, you've got a higher proportion of infertility because some of that bacteria from the anal passage can get into the vagina, which can then change your microbiome, which is like the total mix of bacteria, viruses, and funguses that live within the genital system, which influence fertility. We'll ask you all of those questions. So please don't be surprised or upset if we do. It's not that we're judging you. It's just that it's important that we know just so we can interpret these things. We may offer you some blood tests. You may get a scan of your testicles, particularly if they think that there's a varicocele, which is like a bunch of varicose veins, a sort of big, thick blood vessels that sit next to your testicle and bake them. And we know that the reason your testicles sit outside the body is because they are cooler than the body at that level. And your testicles need to be 3 or 4 degrees cooler than the body for optimum sperm production. So if you're wearing your lycra and squeezing them up against your body, if you're sat down all the time, if you've got thick thighs, you're more generously proportioned and you've got a bigger fat pad above your penis, that's all going to heat your testicles up. If you drive a lot, it's going to heat your testicles up, which is going to reduce the quality and number of your sperm. So it can be as simple as wearing shorts and having a fan at the end of your desk to keep your knackers a bit cooler. Simple things can do that. So they'll talk to you through all of this. They'll talk you through the lifestyle stuff that you want to do, like your caffeine intake, your alcohol intake. Then they'll probably be doing some blood tests on you, looking at your testosterone level, looking at your brain hormones, which control testosterone production and sperm production. And they will probably be doing another semen analysis, and they may do a few more different types of testing on that semen. For example, they might try and check it for infection. They might track your urine for infection, because for men, you've got two different, you've got the urinary system and you've got the reproductive system meeting at the prostate. So you've got two systems coming into one, and issues with infection in either the side, either a urine infection, a sexually transmitted infection, or an infection of the prostate or something could be causing your fertility problem. So it's trying to rule that out. And then it can be difficult, kind of someone going, oh God, I've got chlamydia. And you're like, oh, have you been cheating? And actually, chlamydia can hang around and be really difficult to diagnose in some people, as can other STIs, or infections that aren't considered STIs that aren't tested for in general practice. All these things can come up, and it's really important that we are looking for that in you. And then finally, they'll be doing potentially more challenging tests like DNA fragmentation. I think about that DNA fragmentation is your genetic material snapped. And if you've got your genetic material in pieces, how is that going to fuse together with the genetic material from the egg to create a human? We know that if there's high levels of DNA fragmentation, it's more difficult to get pregnant and you're more likely to miscarry. It is definitely a problem. There's a significant association. And there's two types of DNA fragmentation. There's the single-stranded. So if you imagine DNA is like a helix, so it's two strands attached together, is one broken? And that's single-stranded, or are both broken? And that's double-stranded. Double-stranded tends to happen early and it tends to be related to production issues. Your factories are producing the sperm and the DNA somehow in the production process is being broken. And that group tend to need more often sperm donors. Okay. And then it's the single-stranded DNA fractures, which tend to occur in processing. So basically, once your sperm are made, they sit around for a while maturing. So it takes 3 months of sitting around like wine for them to improve. However, if you've loads of heat, or you've got a varicocele, or you're taking a medication that doesn't actually suit testicular function, then the DNA can fragment. And as a woman's egg gets older, it gets less able to cure the fragmentation. So that's a test that we need to be looking at. Is there a lot of fragmentation? What type of fragmentation is there? And we're learning more and more every time. This is relatively new. The double-stranded DNA fragmentation test becoming popular and available has only really just happened in the past year or so. So there's so much stuff that's improving all the time. It's just there's loads we don't know. So what you get offered may vary from place to place. And so it's really important for you to be informed. And it's a real shame that you have to be informed to be able to chase this up yourself. But I'm afraid that's what you need to know. And it's not necessarily that private is better, because there are lots of private clinics where they won't look at the man for a period of time, and you might have had several rounds of IVF or ICSI. So ICSI is often chosen when there's an issue with the sperm, because let's just bypass the problems and inject the sperm into the egg. And you're like, yeah, but what if the DNA is fragmented? Have you checked that? But then you're not going to get pregnant anyway, or it's more likely to miscarry. So be aware, and then hopefully you're going to choose a better provider. And a lot of private providers do also do NHS work. So you often can get your NHS care with a private provider.
Yeah. I do think you mentioned about being informed and perhaps it being a shame, but I do think as well that our health is our own responsibility, especially as blokes, not burying our head in the sand.
As your doctor, I'm your guide. I'm not the one with the illness. It's your illness, not mine. It's your health concern, not mine. But I'm there to try and advocate for you and support in listening to you, getting the diagnosis, doing the investigations, getting you to the right person or getting you the right treatment. That's what my job is. But equally, it's your body and you're the one putting that stuff in your body that might be causing the problem in the first place. It's your testicles. It's your fertility. I want to support you in that. But some of those choices will be yours. You may choose not to stop smoking. You may choose that it's more important for you to drink and to have that party lifestyle. And that's not for me to judge. That's just your choice. But actually, if we think that's one of the reasons why your fertility up the spout, it's one of those decisions you have to make. And that resentment between partners can be a really tricky thing to navigate. You didn't stop doing this and you didn't do that. And you made me wait till too late. And those arguments we also have to think about. And I talk to my patients a lot about trying not to be resentful of the other person. You know, you are a team. You do not get pregnant without the both of you. There may be choices that actually, you know, you have a few non-alcoholic beers because that's your compromise. On your birthday, you're allowed to party. That's fine. There may be choices you make, but make them with your eyes open.
Great advice.
Yeah, it's good advice. And I would say as well, yeah, get used to uncomfortable questions because it was something that really took me by surprise when I sat down for the first time. And I was asked all kinds of questions. And
Do you use lube? What type of lube do you use? Is it painful to have sex?
Yeah.
Okay. Hello.
Yeah. And I found it very awkward. How many times are you having sex a week? Oh, I don't really want to tell you. But you're here for that reason.
Yeah. I've been very tired. Why are you going to judge me?
Been busy. Ooh,
you know, are we having sex too much? And you're thinking, oh my God, I'm going to look like some sort of weirdo.
Yeah. But once you actually open up to your GP, they're there to support you and guide you, as you've just said. Like, they've got no judgment on it. They're in the wrong job if they are, and they wouldn't have got very far. Do you know what I mean?
By now, I think most of us have heard it all. Although every now and again, you do get a little bit surprised. You just try and hide it with the Botox. So it's important not to be able to raise an eyebrow.
That would be a completely different podcast, wouldn't it? What's the biggest thing that surprised you in your practice?
We won't go there on this podcast.
Not on this one.
I forgot to mention a study that we did, but we asked 100 doctors about male infertility, and 80% of them said they wouldn't feel competent or comfortable interpreting a semen analysis. 90% of them said they wouldn't feel entirely certain about examining for a varicocele, because we tend to examine patients for cancer of the testicle, not the tubes that come off it, if that makes sense. So we have been trained to look for cancer conditions, but not for things that would potentially cause issues with infertility, because we just didn't learn about them as much.
Yeah, well, I had that, exactly that. I found a lump in the shower doing the checks, went to get a scan, and it was, because obviously they were concerned and looking for a tumour. I was concerned about that.
Yeah.
And it was dismissed and almost gleefully, don't worry, it's just a cluster of tubes. Guess what? And again, there's no blame. It's about the education.
We're going to keep banging the drum. So it's definitely going to get better. And there are people like yourself that are charging forward with it as well. So we just got to keep going, haven't we?
But there is so much we can do, and that's the positive thing. There is lots of unexplained infertility was banded around a lot in the past, but actually I think that the more we're working with men, the more times we're finding out what the problem is. And actually, even if men are told that they are infertile, knowing why they're infertile is actually much more powerful than going, we've got no idea. And I think that the fact that we are evolving all the time means that hopefully men in 10 years will have a much better understanding, and we will have a much better understanding of why they may be infertile. We're still in that increasing knowledge phase, like we always are in medicine. And that's what's fascinating, being involved with it, because I'm like, you have to keep on top of things. You go to another conference and there's another sort of research bit that you didn't have any clue about, another test that's available. It's step by step. We're standing on the shoulders of giants, obviously, but we're increasing our knowledge all the time. So don't sit there thinking, there's no point. I'm never going to have a kid. It may be in the end, it turns out you're infertile, but are there experiences like surrogates? Is there potential from sperm donation, egg donation, et cetera, et cetera? There is a huge amount that is available out there.
This has been an amazing discussion. And I say it all the time, but I could generally just sit and talk for hours because it's just a topic that me and Sean are obviously experienced and we're passionate about. We always finish on one question. And that is, if you could give one bit of advice to a man facing fertility challenges, what would it be?
Do the lifestyle stuff before the supplements.
Yeah.
I think everyone these days likes a supplement. They like a quick fix. But actually, the cumulative effect of cutting down your coffee, reducing your drinking, stopping your smoking, stopping your spliff, getting good sleep, doing the right sort of exercise on a regular basis, making sure you're engaged in your relationship with your partner, making sure the sex tries to be as fun as possible when you're being told, come here, I'm ovulating. Do you know what I mean? You want that can be really challenging, right? So I would just say the lifestyle stuff is not just about the food you eat and the environment you have. It's about the relationship with your partner. It's about self-care. It's about all of that stuff. Because if that is in place, potentially your relationship will weather the most difficult outcome. But equally, your relationship being in a good place is the most likely to get you a positive outcome. So yeah, that's what I would say.
Also, obviously, for longevity of life, doesn't it? If you do the right things.
And there's all this evidence now coming out. There's at least 25 different studies showing that if you have got problematic sperm parameters, they're associated with poorer health outcomes long term. Yeah. Cardiovascular disease, cancer risk, diabetes. So I think it's really important that we care for our men at any level. And because fertility issues often occur and we find out about them in younger men, let's look after these younger men, trying to make sure that their general health is advocated for, as well as this period of time they're trying to get pregnant.
I think that's perfect advice. And thanks so much for coming on. It's been a real pleasure. And hope to speak to you again soon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, it was amazing. Thanks so much.
Take care of yourselves. Bye, John. Bye, Kieran.
Bye.
Cheers.
Thanks for listening. If this episode has helped you, do us a quick favour and leave us a review. You don't even have to use your real name. Every single review helps another man find this show when he needs it the most. It's honestly the best way you can help the next guy. If you've got a question or something you'd like us to cover on the mailbag, drop us an email at themalefertilitypodcast@gmail.com. We read every message and we love hearing from our listeners. And if you'd like a bit more expert guidance and support from other men on the same journey as you, you're welcome to join our free private community at nexusfertility.com. It's totally confidential and designed just for you by guys that get it. For our latest updates, follow us on social media at the Male Fertility Podcast. And remember, gents, you're not on your own.